Well, because it's Intelligence Squares, yes, with Jemaine Gray, yeah. And they brought some guy on that was kind of like a GP. And
yeah, he was going an addiction about, doctor.
Yeah, he was talking about smoking. Yeah. And he had such an irrelevant argument going on. And Jemaine Greer kind of came on and clearly hadn't researched.
Well, that's what was really funny, actually, is when she said, I keep quoting it to other people, when she said about, and I said I'd do Playboy, but only if I put my head like between my knees, but no one wants to see a woman's bum hole. And it was hilarious, because I think it was you said, I don't think you've seen pornography in a really long time.
Did I?
Yeah, it was like this 70s woman going, no one wants to see, know that a woman has an ass. It's like, oh dear. Yeah. Very out of date, Jemaine.
Hello. Welcome to Sex Power Money with me, Sarah Pascoe. Today, my guest is the amazing Anna Arrowsmith. She's the author of Rethinking Misogyny, Men's Perceptions of Female Power in Dating Relationships. Formerly, she was the UK's first female porn director under the pseudonym Anna Spann. Today we're going to be talking about her writing and her career, her feminism, where she thinks feminism has failed, the UK laws around porn, whether children should be watching pornography, and just some general stuff about anal sex.
So you were telling me about, so you did a dissertation at your PhD, which was studying male sexuality or masculinity.
It's called Rethinking Misogyny, Men's Experiences of Female Power in Dating Relationships.
Ah, okay.
So I just felt the reason for doing it was I kind of didn't see myself in the feminism that I was brought up on and was involved in. I always felt kind of outside it, and I felt sort of more powerful than the woman that feminism was portraying.
Yeah.
And that debate has been had in feminism between between second and third feminists in the 90s and post-feminists.
Yeah.
But no one was actually talking to men about their experiences of women's power.
Yeah.
So that was my initial interest. But actually what I ended up doing was, because I thought that men would have, like all feminists kind of see it over kind of like an abyss, like men and women's kind of theory are so separate. Mm. And I now argue that we can't really move forward with gender equality unless men and women start talking about how they perceive each other. In other words, we have to invite men to the table.
And so it's interesting that you chose kind of heterosexual dating as the sphere. Mm-hmm. And so when you just, how did you kind of define power? Was it about kind of who asked each other out or who paid for dinner?
It was, well, I took a very generic kind of general idea of power is how does somebody's behaviour get changed because of somebody else's influence over them?
Was
kind of, I did define it more clearly than that in the book. But what I was interested in is I started to look at men, how women influence men.
Mm.
Which is something feminism doesn't really talk about at all.
Yes.
And don't get me, I'm not anti-feminist at all.
No.
I would call myself now a post-structuralist, which basically means that, like I said, for a start, you get masculine women and you get feminine men. So you get this kind of mixing up of, you know, it's not biological in that sense that you can have a certain sort of energy and force around you and a set of ideals. Because I always grew up with the ideals that were masculine, which was, you know, you've got to be strong, you've got to hide your insecurities.
And it's odd that we defined those as masculine at the time, because I'm the same, rather than a form of being a woman. That you think, oh, I'm a woman with these male traits, rather than this is also within the
sphere of womanhood. Why call them male traits?
Exactly.
You see what I say?
Mm.
And I used to say this to students when I was teaching at UCSB. I was like, we kind of have to still use the terms masculine and feminine for these things because they're still very attached to ideas of what men and women are. They're not what Judith Butler, the philosopher who's a post-structuralist, says, free-floating artifices.
No. Yeah.
Just interrupting the podcast to clarify here, we're talking about Judith Butler, an American philosopher and gender theorist who influenced third-wave feminism.
You know, actually, the way we look at anybody is through a gendered lens, and that's why Butler says that we can't really differentiate between gender and sex. Sex being the body and the hormones, including the hormones, and gender being everything else about human experience, including how we interpret sex and how we scientifically interpret. We don't leave our kind of prejudices at the door when we start being scientific.
I found it really worse. Shocking. not in like a, but just as in, I was surprised when they did studies with small children and how early they define sex, how important it is, as in it's really ingrained in a pre-cultural sense that the really important things that we learn about each other, like that's the main thing.
Yeah. And it's crazy. And Butler says, you know, we if you look at the human body, you know, I don't know what figure it is, but 90-95% of our bodies between a man and a woman are the same. But we focus on the 5%.
Yeah.
So that's not, you know, that's different. So what we're actually seeing is like a tangerine and a satsuma and seeing them as entirely different fruits, like, you know, like a tangerine to a pineapple.
Yeah.
We're exaggerating difference between men and women.
And also treating them so differently.
Yes.
Like,
And you're born onto this kind of conveyor belt, one pink, one blue, that sends you off. And Butler says, you know, if were it biological, we wouldn't need to police gender all the time. We constantly police the way we look at each other, the way we sit.
Yeah.
You know, if a woman sat with her legs wide apart like that on the train, that would be okay. We've got man spreading as a noun now, but that's a new idea.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, historically is way, you know, people would be staring at that woman and she'd feel the need to close
her legs.
It's
a huge statement.
Yeah.
It's really interesting as well with trans women that they have prescribed behaviours as well, as in because you're a woman now, you have to do things rather than you're freed from all of this because
you've
seen it all from another expression.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And when what people misunderstand about transgender people, they kind of see them as faking, quote unquote, being a woman or being a man. But what actually they're doing is learning as an adult, being a man and woman, exactly what we learnt as a baby.
Yeah.
Only we did it incrementally and we grew into this world and into a gendered world that we just fitted into, we were meant to fit into at least. And so we don't know how much we're constantly kind of batting each other slightly left, right to keep ourselves in the centre. Whereas a transgender person, we notice it in them, but they notice it in themselves. And often when, what I found really interesting, because I interviewed transgender people, was that if you ask the question, when did they first know or how do they find out they were transgender? Often it's other people telling them that they are not normal.
Yeah, because of a behaviour.
Because of a behavioural thing.
Mm.
And so actually you think it's a born kind of sense of like, you know, I am not this, but actually it can be much more complex. And I interviewed a few people who assume first they come out as gay and they think, yeah, that's it, I'm
that's
gay.
It,
and then like 10 years later, they're like, no, this is not quite
not
enough. This is not right. And actually they're heterosexual, but they're transgender.
Yeah, it's so fascinating, isn't it?
And so I kind of, when I started researching masculinity, I sort of found out that, oh, that's what I am, a masculine woman, even though I don't look it. You know, you don't have to be butch in any way. You can just have that kind of energy. And, you know, my first emotion is often anger.
So you get frustrated and you get
aggressive. I have to hold it in. And, you know, we teach women to hold that in much more, which is part of the reason why women have higher levels of mental illness.
Yeah, I also wonder about, is it about... So I have a PCOS, which gives you raised testosterone, and I sometimes get these rages, and that's when I know my hormones are really out of balance.
Uh-huh.
And it does make me think of men. I think, is the reason I don't thump people because I would lose? But I wonder if I had grown up in a stronger body, would I lash out because I know it would be a successful way to shut someone up?
Yeah.
Because I feel the urge to hit people.
Well, the other thing is you have to prove yourself, whereas a man, I mean, height in men makes a massive difference.
Yeah.
My husband's 6'6",
yeah,
and I see him, like I was just talking the other day about a couple of old guys that haven't had him go with me because I swim 3 miles a week, and I have done for like 10, 12 years. And over that time, I've had 2-3 kind of older guys be kind of aggressive towards me. Every single time my husband turns up, stands in the water and it's, like this. And suddenly there's deference. And it's just, my husband's done nothing. He's just stand up.
But this is also interesting about us as an animal. It's like, there isn't that much separation from us, the human being, with intellect and conscious thought and the ape, and a bigger ape comes along and there's a split second judgment, which is I'm in trouble now. I can argue with you, I'm a high status man in this situation, swimmer man against you, but higher status man comes along, younger, strong, bye.
These basic things come back. And so we're a mixture, aren't we, as human beings? We're kind of like, we set up strata, social strata, like you say, like you can be successful, you can have cultural capital, for instance, and be very powerful.
Yes.
So we've kind of like, you know, changed it a bit since then. But the thing is, I started to interview men about how they experience women to have power, and I did things like violence, women's violence, women's sexual attraction. Mm. Now, I come from a history of gender and representation. My first degree was at St. Martin's doing film, and I always learn the sort of theory that sort of men own the screen and they put, you know, they objectify women, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and following their stories, and they speak a lot more, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and the sexuality specifically, I always heard that there was one, it'll come to me in a minute, but there was one paper specifically that talks about how men are powerful by owning this male gaze.
Oh, yeah.
And my whole of my porn career was about, no, I have a female gaze and I'm going to be as strong as I can possibly be. And you know, can be equally as good and better still.
And so when you got the idea, okay, I want to spin this, I can't find it elsewhere, so I'm going to make it.
Yes, it was partly that. But this, I'll just finish off with the gender thing.
Sorry, yeah.
The male gaze thing. When I interviewed men about how they experience, you know, taking a women's beauty and also commercial use of beauty, men rarely blamed women, although they didn't really respect women's efforts put into how they made themselves beautiful.
Okay.
And they often minimise the female gaze, for instance, how women look at men.
Yes.
That's very interesting. Yeah. They never spoke of women's views of them. And that was kind of like a massive elephant in the room.
Mm.
And the only time they ever spoke of women's views of them was when I asked them about their penis. And then all of a sudden, loads of them suddenly started having these kind of vicarious women by saying, oh, well, I've never had any complaints. Oh, my boss used to say, my female boss used to say I'd a bulge through my trousers. My girlfriends used to say X, Y, and Z. Mm. Suddenly women were in the room.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're interesting. It's very interesting what men do and don't say, what they miss out.
Yeah.
That female gaze is one of them. But when I asked them about how they experience women, they were quite angry about being manipulated by images of women's sexuality.
Yes.
Not specifically pornography, because that kind of is the go-to place for that, I think. But it's really like selling them products through fantasy and women.
There's a bigger lie in advertising than pornography, probably. Mm. Like, I mean, there might be lies about female sexuality in a lot of pornography, as in this kind of sex will make this woman come six times, or this kind of woman is going to have sex with you when she answers the door. But in advertising, what they're saying is you buy this car, suddenly you're a different person with a younger, hotter partner. Or in the Lynx effect, which I think is really fascinating, that whole kind of women will literally chase you, you dweeby adolescent. Like, they are being told a lie. They're told that you can buy this. You don't have to make any more effort than your smell or your car.
And if you match that with their kind of elephant in the room of not admitting what women see in them, they don't want to think, it's like sticking their fingers in, la, 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 who don't want to hear. And when you look at Men's Health magazine and stuff like that, the way they get round the dangerously feminising aspect of the female gaze, but also what's also known as kind of the homosexual kind of look, you know, being taking care of yourself, is to break it up into projects.
Yes.
So it's work. So it's like get a six pack in 6 weeks and stuff like that. So you put the man as the center of his own realm, and he is enabling himself to get this the women will like.
Yes.
So he's kind of keeps control of it, which is a complete lie, really.
But also it's interesting because it's demonstrating strength rather than, oh, she just likes your stomach, mate, or he just likes your stomach.
Exactly. Like, so say there is that the men get to stay within what's known as a successful masculine performance. They get to stay within hegemonic masculine realms, and the women are kind of like a payoff for that. So there's this kind of disconnect, which is why I wanted to interview men about it, about women, because we don't know anything about this, and especially like female violence and sexual assault and stuff like that. It was really quite eye-opening to see how men position themselves vis-a-vis the women involved, but also other men, what other men think of them.
Yes.
And how they...
And so when you say violence, do you mean a kind of a cross-gender violence?
When women are hurting men.
Yes. And so it is a real... it's a real problem, because, again, whenever there are people and we don't hear from them, Like, we don't have a space as a society to discuss that violence because we feel like there's this bigger problem, which is mothers and children who have nowhere to go and our government isn't supporting them.
Yeah, which is also true.
Yeah, yeah. And no, it's
this is the thing. They people want to polarise it.
It isn't like, oh, because you've helped him, who cares about it? It's like, no, we care about everyone.
Yeah. This is how we've got to get past this polarised thinking that's really damaging in lots of ways. Like, male, female, good, bad.
Yeah. Well, actually, this is what brings me back to talking to you about porn, because the first thing I found so surprising was that we have this narrative about pornography, feminism, some areas of feminism, not all feminists, have this narrative of pornography where, like, women are debased and abused and men are at home masturbating to it. And the first thing that struck me was that men make pornography and they're kind of irrelevant, as in the men who are in it, as in they are never victims or degraded.
Yeah.
Or if people are being manipulated in the making of it, then that affects both genders.
Well, the best example of that is, because I used to work for Television X and we used to have to do this my first job was doing the censorious edits when we brought American stuff in and it had to go for English telly. And one of the problems is in America, there was a massive interest in shaving, which caused problems in England because it showed more. The whole point of shaving the body.
This is a porn channel.
Yes, it's a porn channel.
Yeah, and the films were made
in America
and everything was shaved.
Yeah. Yeah. So what happens? This is the thing. This is where feminist pornography, people who are anti, the feminists who are anti pornography, they get this completely wrong. They think that the shaving of the female vulva is about prepubescence.
Yes.
It isn't.
No.
How could it be? These women are curvaceous women with big breasts.
Yeah, they've got all of these post-puberty signals.
Yes.
There's a different genre, which is kind of hebephilic.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And they still have some pubes, which if you're prepubescent, wouldn't.
Yeah.
What it actually, the actual history of that comes out of the Clinton administration in America, relaxing censorship there.
Yeah.
So the American producers ask both men and women in porn to shave.
Yeah.
And the men shave actually greater areas. They shave the whole of their chest.
They have
chest.
A lot more hair to
they
shave.
They have their wax, you know, the back sack and crack and all that malarkey done. And they're just as shaved, if not more so, than the women. And yet there's no discussion about that being done for sort of paedophilic reasons.
No, but it has again become much more culturally popular, kind of off the back of it, perhaps.
Oh, yeah. And
which
and
is a different discussion. I never
deny that people aren't influenced by porn. I just don't think that they're totally influenced by it. And I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing.
Yes.
And this is a good example.
Yeah.
Pubic lice has dropped through the floor.
Yeah, they've got that in Amsterdam. They've got that little museum with like the last existing species of some of them because they've gone extinct.
Yeah. So what's bad about that? And that, you know, I'm old enough to remember what a pube at the back of your throat felt like.
Yeah.
Young people today hopefully don't.
No, they'll never know. They'll just they'll just hear about it. That's the thing I think so important is sometimes in a discussion to go, just as something's happening, does it mean it's necessarily negative? It is negative if people feel like they're not allowed to have pubic hair.
Mm-hmm.
And that's same with anything culturally, like thinking you have to be a size 8 is a negative thing. But feeling that you have choices or can express yourself or that isn't necessarily a bad thing just because your grandma didn't think she would ever wax all her pubic hair off.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And the example I always use was when I was younger, it was very shameful to do anal sex.
Yes, yeah.
To try it. And now it isn't. Like, it would if you did it, so someone would shout at you in the pub.
It's a sign of kind of sexual prowess in women. Like, I know I do comedy as my job, and so there's a lot of ownership no matter who's talking. And when women talk about doing anal, I'm always very impressed. Like, oh, my God, get her. She really knows what she's doing. But she's got lube in her bedroom and everything. Yeah.
But the thing is, you know, some people will argue that has made women feel that they have to do anal.
Yeah.
And there are going to be some people that feel that they have to, but there's going to be a heck lot more who try it and either like it or don't like it. Try it sometimes with some people and not others.
Yeah.
And don't feel pressured. So I would rather have, you know, the cat out of the bag and have people able to do stuff and not be automatically shamed for it.
Yeah.
And have some people that feel that they because really that's just about them having sexual autonomy anyway. They feel pressured in sex anyway. It's not going to be just anal.
So sexual obligation is a very different, is a separate thing no matter what the acts are. So when I was growing up, I couldn't understand. There used to be jokes, like in a sitcom, about getting oral on his birthday, that kind of joke, as if it was a thing that women hated, heterosexual women hated, but would do as a treat kind of thing. And I think anal's now replaced that in those kind of jokes. But I really liked having a dick in my mouth. So the idea that that wasn't, that like, it's only for him. And she's like, oh, God. And so, again, that really changed in about 10 or 15 years. And so I would have, I don't like anal sex, but with oral sex, I'd be like, no, but it's a complete, it's, it all comes down to the autonomy and not feeling obligated to do anything.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so that's where I think, obviously, sex education becomes so vitally important, and especially sex education around the things that people see in porn, because when I was when I was a teenager, I was still, like, before the internet, looking in the dictionary for rude words. And so I knew things like, I remember, like, at school, we were obsessed with frotting and frottage, like these things that we knew what they were, whereas now, of a similar age, people have seen things, and in some ways they're really educated. But things like, that anal sex needs lube, and that that it's very, very thin skin there, and this whole thing, and you'll have heard about it, like the danger of, like, injuries or girls off school with anal injuries. There just has to be a conversation at an age where parents are very uncomfortable with the fact that an adult's talking to their child about those things.
Yeah. And it is difficult because I don't think I wanted to have a conversation like that with my parents.
I don't think it can be parents. Like, I felt like my parents' sexuality, both separately, so they were teenagers when they had me, so when they were then having quite vibrant sex lives in their 30s, I found it so intrusive. I absolutely think they have to be separate spheres. There is a state responsibility from someone who's not related to you. And so a parent can just know someone responsible who is absolutely completely CRB checked up to their eyelashes is explaining to my... there's somewhere for them to answer, ask questions.
And this is the thing as well, like they're bringing in a sort of an age ban and porn in the UK.
Oh, yeah, so let's talk about some of the laws in the UK. So this is going to happen. So this will probably go out in September.
Okay.
And when is the law changing?
It's July. They're bringing in age verification. And again, lots of problems with it, not least the fact that young people, if they're tech savvy, are going to get around it anyway.
So this is something where if you're on a computer on your phone and you try to download, so say it's something like YouPorn, like a tube site, it will then want to definitely verify that the user is over 18.
Yeah, you've got to put your credit card details in.
Credit card details in to verify who you are.
Yeah.
So you could just use a parent's credit card details.
I don't know that. But
I'm not suggesting.
I don't know how. This is the thing. The technology of this thing, we've not really been told anything
about. It's
going
to be like
that
silly capture thing to check you're not a robot, isn't it? So basically they've covered their backs to go, well, we asked, but you tick a box and go, I'm not a robot. I can see six lorries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what's happening is, you know, for the sake of, I'm not technologically minded as much to really know how these blocks work, but I keep getting told that young people are able to get around them. And if that is the case, I mean, really, it's just a case of taking the phone off them at night or something, you know, just don't give your kid a phone until they're old enough to 16 or whatever. Yeah. I don't know. But it's really not letting them run loose with any internet or at home instead of, like, you know, interacting with a family or something, you know. But one of the interesting things, there's one study that showed that actually kids aren't accessing pornography at a younger age than they used to. It's stayed pretty much the same, which is like, I think about age 13.
Yeah.
Because historically there were magazines, you picked up your older brother's magazines dad's VHS.
My cousins, I've got lots of cousins, and the uncles had videos, and the cousins got them at around a similar age because curiosity isn't new, and curiosity about sex isn't new. Like, every generation had a different version.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And we have this, especially in Britain, we have this prudish, I think in America too, to be fair, attitude around age of consent and childhood sexuality. We kind of acknowledge that Freud said that there are erogenous stages that we grow up with. So from quite young, and I remember having sexual almost wet dreams. Yes. If I were a boy, they'd be called wet dreams. Yeah. Though it wasn't, you know, ejaculation like that. But I remember having very visceral experiences in my sleep. When I was very young, I mean, certainly under 10.
Yeah. Also, I very similarly, I used to make everyone act out very sexual scenarios with me. So I would have been very young, 6 and 7. Mm. And I didn't know it was sex. What I knew was I wanted to be buried in Egypt and dug up by all of these men with diggers. And it was very sexual. And children did not want to play with me because she's like, she's going to make us bury her again.
I was the same. And I wrote a chapter in a book on aesthetics and pornography. And I called it My Pornographic Development. And I talked about my imagination when I was a kid of having these dreams of sailors tying me up on a mast and saving me as the one woman that was worth saving. It's always very arrogant. Our fantasies, and them having, you know, and having some sort of penile. It wasn't actually a penis, but it was it was like a tube or something like this. This weird kind of, not quite knowing the human body because I was too young and stuff. But have a kind of an idea of it before I was told about sexual.
I had thing at primary school where I used to like having my hands in my pants. It's a very comforting thing, and. And like when I said that down my pants, sometimes they weren't in my knickers, but they'd be in my trousers, hands between my legs, listening to the teacher. And it was this thing of like, she kept pulling my hands out and putting them back on the table. And I didn't understand for years what her problem was with me putting my hands down my trousers, because to her it was that girl is touching herself, whereas I was just holding myself.
Yeah.
Like actually it wasn't, for me, it wasn't connected with sex, but to an adult projecting onto me.
Yeah.
It was, or if someone had looked in the room and thought, oh, she's not stopping that girl touching herself.
Yeah, and this is the thing. We kind of acknowledge young kids have these sexualities, and we know, like, baby boys will get an erection and stuff like this. But we're not a mature enough society that we're able to actually say, do you know what, kids, you know, they're being pumped full of hormones to have sex from, I don't know, age 12, 13, 14 onwards. What is the body telling us? Mm. What does the age 16 mean as an age of consent in the UK? You know, the Netherlands and Germany will be like 13, 14,
of course,
and in America, it's 18. And really there, that the idea that you have sex under 18, they're really quite adamant that you don't.
Yeah.
And when I, you know, it's kind of like as an English person that lost her virginity at 16, it's like, do you know what? I'm not going to define myself in terms of your kind of idea of paedophilia because it wasn't that. You know, the guy was much, well, not much older than me, but he was, he was 21 or something.
Yeah.
And maybe a little younger, 19. But so still.
Is it hand in hand with religion there? Because they obviously they also have a lot more pressure to like wait until marriage or.
Yeah, unfortunately.
And so it does seem very backwards. And the drinking laws are similarly kind of prohibited.
And the same sort of experience. Like you read these sociological papers about when I was studying masculinity, was guys then, you know, they can't drink, but then they go to university and then they go to these. Sorority, what do they call them?
Yes, fraternity.
Clubs, and they do all this ridiculous stuff because they haven't had a drink before 21, well, which is way too late.
That's why I always remember growing up and the whole people would talk about how the French knew how to do it because children would have wine with dinner and wouldn't be binge drinkers like we were because we waited till we were 15 or 16.
Yeah.
So can I ask you about the first time, so we talked a little bit about like kind of very young child sexuality. When did you first know that porn existed as a thing?
Well, my imagination.
Yeah.
This is the thing. You know, when anti-porn people argue, it's just like, I want to stop them and saying, are you saying that women don't have a sexual imagination?
Oh, yeah.
And if you're saying that they do, are you saying they shouldn't film it?
Yeah.
There's some reason why women shouldn't film it. You're saying men shouldn't either. But why shouldn't women? You know, if supposedly we're the quote unquote fairer sex, everyone's much nicer as being a woman, which is not something I agree with. Anyone that's been to an all-girls school will disagree with that.
Yeah.
My first images of sexuality came from me. Mm. They came from my dreams when I was a kid. And then I remember very vividly walking we at our school in Kent, that you had to walk up to the hockey pitch. It was like 100 yards up the road. And I just remember seeing in the gutter some images of slides of two or three slides, and it was a woman literally. I mean, it could have been it was so stereotypical. She was in leopard skin, kind of like little negligee, and her tits were out and stuff like this. And that I saw that in the street and I was just absolutely transfixed by it. And I just couldn't stop thinking about it. And then another time we were walking home and there was a guy that was masturbating in the car and we all laughed and ran past him, and but in broad daylight.
Yeah.
And I've seen that twice in my life, actually, walking home. So none of this is involving a kind of massive industry and stuff. But then, you know, pornography per se, I mean, I was anti-porn.
Yeah, so that's really interesting. So why was that
at that point? So because it was at the time of Claire Short's campaign, Ban the Top Shelf, and I've always had a very strong interest in women's rights.
Mm.
Going right back to, if I look at the date, I think Gloria Gaynor's I Will Survive came out in 77, 76. And I remember that being like an anthem when I was a kid. I just thought, oh, my God, so you will survive, you know.
Yeah.
So this kind of young thing. And when Thatcher got in 79, when she was campaigning, I remember thinking, oh, I want a woman. My mum and dad were like, you really don't want her. I didn't understand the idea of, we were not a conservative family, so I really didn't get that.
But you felt this kind of woman
thing.
Of her,
and when she got in, and I've always said, like, when Clinton was going in the last round, I was just like, you know, people say it doesn't matter if she's a woman. I said, it does matter.
Mm.
It mattered to people of colour in the States when Obama got in, because what you can see, you can be.
Yeah.
And I always knew, I grew up knowing that it was possible I could do the top job in the country. And that's really important for young women and people of colour as well. Excuse me. And so I saw all this, and the only narrative around was this anti-porn thing. So the whole of this kind of like feminist kind of early 80s kind of drive towards getting women accepted was just twinned. Women are suppressed because pornography exists.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it, that we think that those women are actually, even if they are willing and earning their living from it, are actually to blame about how the rest of women are treated.
Yeah.
So it's a really odd narrative. It's a really odd narrative. It's like people who think immigration is the reason they don't have a job. Is they go, oh, this plus that equals, even though there's absolutely no
correlation.
There is no correlation.
At all, and I always say the example to think about is, because back in the day, the reason why sort of violence and pornography are twinned together in our imagination is because there were Andrea Dworkin and Catherine MacKinnon.
Andrea Dworkin was a radical feminist and author who is still much debated and discussed to this very day. She's considered quite controversial.
Yeah.
We're a couple in America who fought to ban pornography, basically.
Yes.
And it went through the 80s. And the reason I say to people as a thought experiment, why isn't boxing, professional boxing, linked? Why isn't it blamed for aggression on the streets, right?
Yeah.
Why isn't that linked automatically, that people see people on the screen and they mimic what they do and they go out and they are more aggressive because of it? There's no reason why that didn't exist.
There's no stigma to anything unless it has sex in it.
Except that there wasn't a Dworkin-MacKinnon type of people in the 80s or whenever who argued that.
Mm.
So it just was happenstance that these two people came through and they tried to... you know, they try to argue a point, and that got stuck in our imagination, regardless of the fact that the social science does not support it.
I also think, especially with Dworkin, who I think is an amazing thinker and writer, which isn't to say, but I think she used such, a bit like Gayle Dines now, she used such powerful propaganda in anti-porn.
Yes.
So it's a bit like if you were going to talk about Hollywood and the movies, and then you found something where, like, and then this horse was decapitated and they ripped its entrails out for like one film. We're like, and that's the movies.
Yeah.
And if you watch lots of films, you go, that's not the movies. That's a really awful thing that happened to a horse.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Because awful things do happen. Like,
yeah.
But
Dworkin's book is, I mean, what's really interesting about it is the amount of detail that she goes into.
Oh, very specific,
and very erotic.
Yes.
I mean, I read that book and it has actually turned me on constantly through
it. It's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because, so anyone listening, Dworkin wrote a book, an anti-pornography book, where she goes through different porns and she talks about power dynamics, and she's very interested in like women being tied up and held open and back. but she, because it's a book with no pictures, she has to describe them to you in
And she does so. I remember one line where she says, and the woman's hair was a shade lighter than the background wall or something like that. She goes into so much detail. And, you know, anyone that's read Foucault will kind of know this kind of power dynamics that's going on, that, you know, being anti-porn, the verve, the drive behind people's anti-pornography is actually sexual. It's actually of pornography.
Well, it happens quite a lot where people have stuff on their computers, or it's a bit like, actually, do you know what it's a bit like, is priests, people who try and deny themselves sexuality, who literally in the pulpit saying all these evil things that they are thinking about constantly.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's two sides of the same coin. And I mean, and similarly, what's the name you mentioned? Gail Dines. Like, her book is terribly researched.
Well, so I read her book before I watched any pornography.
Oh, right.
And I found that's it. So I had a very naive upbringing. I have always been kind of feminist, and I always thought anyone can do whatever they want to, including women, was my opinion. And then I read Gail Dines' book, and I honestly thought that was all porn, the porn that she describes. So she, and again, I think she's an amazing writer and thinker, right? So this is not me to say, in terms of a discussion, that she shouldn't exist. But she describes like these things that she saw when she started, opened a porn tube site. And it's literally kind of like hangings and being urinated on and crying and blood. And I mean, she's describing kind of full-scale assaults, and it's really terrifying. And I honestly thought if I opened YouPorn on my computer, that would be... And I was so surprised at how tame it was.
Yeah, shall I tell you why? This is why her book is so fundamentally flawed.
Yeah.
She didn't realise... if you're doing any sort of cultural research, there are sets of guidelines that you have to apply.
Yes.
And if you get a fundamental flaw in a premise in your book, then that actually, as per logic, decries... Yeah. It negates the whole thing.
Yeah.
And the problem is, she says, I put the word pornography into my search, engine, and this is what I came at. And her main argument is, this is not your mum and this is not your dad's Playboy magazines. Yeah. This has moved on. This is far worse.
Yeah.
Now, anyone that knows anything about how search engines work, they go on your previous searches,
algorithms,
and all the stuff you've ever done online in any capacity. Mm. She's somebody that writes constantly articles about rape, about female abuse, etc., etc. If she's opening up that viewership,
that's why it happens.
That's entirely subjective. She has absolutely no grounds to project that, because as a pornographer, I put pornography into mine, and mine's absolutely clean as anything.
Yes, that's it. So for 2 years, I was researching my book and watching. I was trying to watch a big variety of the pornography that exists, including really feminist. I never got onto anything really horrible, actually.
Because you don't have to unless you want to go look for it.
But it doesn't come up. Like, and every single window...
You have to go looking for it.
It might be... There's a lot. It's very interesting, the power dynamics. There's lots of babysitters, which I think is such an interesting power dynamic, isn't it? And obviously a fantasy for apparently people of every age group. Babysitters is one of the highest search things.
And you notice how, if you look at that, I think is it Pornhub that does it, changes every year.
Yes, yeah, the culture changes.
Culture changes, and that's fascinating.
Every year, the Pornhub website release a huge amount of statistics on men and women in different countries, the search terms, the new search terms in terms of the porn that people are looking for, and all kinds of interesting things like that.
I mean, I know the cosplay, there was kind of like an anime thing, I think, when I was teaching last year, the year before, that was number one.
Yeah.
And so that now it's babysitters. But next year, a lesbian porn, girl on girl, which is considered soft, was actually huge. I don't know if it's this year or last year.
Yeah. Well, porn for women is what they said in 2018. That was the highest search term across all the countries. It is really fascinating, their data. Mm. So that was one of the things I found really surprised, because I just thought all porn was going to be men punching women in the face.
And if you listen to the anti-porn, that's what they say. But there's also a lot. I mean, this is the good thing about pornography. There's the democratization of the imagination, but also the democratization of the body. I say to women, whatever it is you don't like about your body, say you're hairy or you're fat or whatever, put that into a search term and put plus porn.
Yeah.
And you will find a load of sites that find that's the most attractive thing about you.
Yeah.
And this really goes against a very dominant heteronormative idea that we have in the mainstream about what a specific type of beauty is. Porn really disrupts that.
It does, and that's what's interesting about some of the feminist arguments against it. They talk about it as if everyone's a white, pneumatic is the word that was used, blonde.
Yeah.
And the idea, I think blonde is synonymous with stupid. And also, there was an anti-porn petition recently, and they keep talking about young Nubal and this idea, because young is kind of again associated with victim and powerless or maybe bad decision exploitation. And actually, no, advertising is like that, television is like that. There's all of these where it's so much worse.
Yeah.
And actually, porn, there are people of every different body type who work.
And check this out. I mean, I can't remember the name of the research, but one guy did. He looked back to the early 80s, and it was done about 5 years ago, and he looked over all of the DVDs that have been released in the history. I think it wasn't just America at the time. And he found that the most average porn star was, I believe she was 22 years old. She was 34 B cup, and she had brown hair.
Yeah.
She wasn't the pneumatic blonde at all.
Yeah. Maybe you're right about mainstream. People think more like Babe Station, kind of like soft pornography. So here's an interesting thing then. In terms of like masturbation, female masturbation has just been denied.
Mm-hmm.
And male masturbation has been heavily discouraged as like a wasting of seed.
Yeah, historically,
kind of going to shrivel up
and send you blind and all that.
Yeah, hairy palms. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is, the shame with masturbation is... I think it's, I don't know if it's bodily contained now. I mean, it used to be like being found masturbating, like if your mum opened the door or something like that. But now, because it's image-based, a lot of it, you might not actually be found to be masturbating, but someone might find your porn
on
your computer. the thing is, you know, it can be very opposite to the type of person you are.
Yeah, people don't identify. Mm. So a little bit like we were talking about earlier, like I don't identify as someone who wants to be buried sexually.
Yeah.
But there's a point in my childhood, if someone could see into my brain.
Yes, exactly.
And then I'd be like, but hang on.
You feel really exposed.
Yeah, because, and definitely that's what's interesting, isn't it? Like with rape fantasy and the difficulty people always have with the idea that that's a kind of very common female fantasy. The difficulty is that's so separate.
Yes.
The things that make that sexy and imagining is so separate from the crime.
Exactly. This, again, this polarised thinking about sort of good and bad. There's a whole load of grey in between the black and white. The fact is, a rape fantasy is by, you know, its own logic, an oxymoron, because, yes, women definitely, and men, and this is the thing, if we separate it out to women, then we don't really see the whole picture, because men get that too.
Yeah.
Men definitely, in fact, men are allowed to say, if you go back to Benny Hill being, you know, chased off the cliff by a load of naked women or you know, bikini clad women, that's kind of like joked about and liked.
Yeah.
But people do have these fantasies, and with women it's difficult because, you know, when a woman has that fantasy, she is, you know, describing, she's writing the actor, she's writing the scenario, she's doing everything herself, which is completely different from the act of rape, where you have absolutely no say whatsoever. So it's an entirely different thing.
Yeah, and because it involves desire and consent and kind of like supplication by choice, which is the fact that it's like when you describe like the sailors, it's like,
But it's by choice, And it comes, and it tends to be kind of linked to... I don't know if this is true, but I've read that it's linked to women who feel sort of like disempowered in their own sexuality. So it's about guilt-free sex.
Yes.
So
yeah,
it's about like, oh, well, it didn't, you know, I didn't choose it.
Yeah.
Therefore, I can't be blamed for it.
I was reading something really interesting that was about 50 Shades of Grey and this resurgence of kind of people who don't practice S&M, but the idea of it. And they were saying, because women are so busy and have to do everything, the idea of being tied up and someone else doing it.
Always,
I think sometimes that's what's so fascinating about fantasizing about the opposite.
Yeah.
Very empowered people quite often would love someone else to be in charge
sexually. Well, this is the case. I mean, if you know the men who pay dominatrixes to...
They're all kind of... Yeah,
High achievers often, and it's about relinquishing control for a change.
Yeah.
So, you know, we really, you know, we're in a very sort of a young, you know, immature way of understanding sexuality. And if you start sort of saying straightforward things like women who have fantasies about rape a week, that's completely misunderstanding it. It may be that they don't feel engage in their own sexuality, yes. maybe.
And I'm not saying guilty. That's definite. Yeah.
Or so they feel guilty about sort of asking, you know, for that. Mm. Or even, like you say, if you're too busy, if you're a person that goes, gets, you have been brought up with those kind of masculine ideals,
yeah.
you feel that you're letting yourself down if you acquiesce at anything.
Yeah.
And they may be very powerful in the rest of their life and they just want to acquiesce in this one area.
But I think it should be so much part of, this is why the importance of talking about it would have to be at school, but talking to children about pornography, because the idea that you are separate from what turns you on, or that especially someone who's masturbating to a certain kind of porn, who might have just found a thing of like, that's my thing, that's what I search for, but that doesn't mean that might be what you search for in your real life.
Yes,
or
absolutely.
Sometimes watching extreme things and having, because people can have very extreme, powerful orgasms to things that are kind of so novel. And obviously that's the kind of science that's really interesting about novelty.
Yeah.
And
it's like gaming. Yeah. Mm. Like, you know, people kind of think that, what does it mean when these guys are kind of like aggressive, you know, young men are playing these games and they're really aggressive. Does that mean that they want to be aggressive, but they can't? Or does it just mean that they don't want that in their real life, actually, but they're kind of intrigued by something that is just like through a little keyhole.
There's a catharsis argument that they used to use about football and things, because obviously you have kind of tens of thousands of people who love a team and it's very tribal, and you have a small minority who were hooligans or create fights and take it to this extra level. And the same thing happens with gaming. There'll always be one person, there'll always be one murder where you go, oh God, that was inspired by that thing. And then you've got hundreds of thousands of people just living lives going, yeah, I played Grand Theft Auto my entire teen years and have never stolen a car.
Yeah,
have never wanted to.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And people don't worry, like you say with the boxing, people don't go, oh, they're playing FIFA all day. They're going to become professional footballers, whether we like it or not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And other things, you know, when we look at how we talk about addiction, like I can't remember the woman's name, but she's an ex-alcoholic, and she gives the example, like, you know, the amount that we use the internet now, why don't we talk in terms of us being addicted to it? Because can we live without it now? Mm. And stuff like this. So it's the social framing of something, and
that's
you know, to a large point, subjective. Alcohol's fine, you know, cocaine not fine, you know.
Yeah. So we're going to wrap up in a little while. So I wanted to ask you if there was one thing. Oh, actually, I'm going to ask you two questions. So the first one is, when you meet someone at a party, a stranger, and they ask you what you do, what's the most common misconception about kind of your work?
Well, people always think I was a porn star and I wasn't.
Yes.
Because I knew that the most powerful position was behind the camera, and I knew, and what the terrible thing is, I knew that the prejudice is that if I did it as I did have fantasies about doing pornography. Mm. One, I don't want, you know, if I wanted to make a career out of it, I didn't want to go and shag all the ugly men and with horrible producers. Yeah. Like, they may not be abusive, but they're not good looking and the sex is kind of crap. I didn't want to actually have
aspects
that reality.
Of it. It's what's interesting about, I was listening to a podcast with a porn star the other day, and she's obviously really brilliant, but I thought, my job, so I do comedy and it has no stigma attached to it, so I can really moan about it and go, yeah, I'm really great. I'm self-employed. I have a charge of my own life, but I don't have a social life. I don't get to do this. Sometimes the gigs are so rubbish. Whereas a porn star who's aware of all of the negativity can't go, yeah, sometimes it's really rubbish and the guys are ugly and I don't like certain producers. They have to go, she has to go, I love my job.
Yeah,
I'm so
exactly,
lucky.
Yeah.
And it's a shame. And I hope there does become a point where she can also go, some of it's shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm not changing it. This is my job. I prefer this to other options open to me.
And the fantastic thing about doing porn as well is you are kind of really cutting edge on the edges of society. And it draws us, if there's one common denominator I see in pornography, and it draws all sorts of people from different backgrounds, it's kind of like, fuck you to you know, regular culture to a certain extent. And that will take you a long way, probably a long way out of your comfort zone. And because that's another thing we never talk about, seeing it as porn as an Olympic sport. Like, you know, we talk about people in a negative way being taken outside of their, you know, the regular kind of mental or emotional comfort zone. But, you know, if it were a physical sport, we'd be going, my God, they're transcending their own boundaries.
Yeah.
You know, they're trying stuff, they're becoming stronger, they have more knowledge, they have more experience and stuff like that. We don't have that kind of scaffolding for pornography. We can't see it as positive at all.
No, I think that outsider's perspective is really interesting because it makes people, they were already a little bit anarchic, or that realizing how society changed around them, or the way people reacted around them changed. I guess it is. It's like you've gone to a kind of space of human understanding that lots of people can't. So is that why there's quite a strong kind of community and cohesion and understanding of people from all kinds of places in the industry?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, yeah, I can't speak for other countries, but I remember it being, you know, people getting on sort of fairly well. There were, it's like any industry, there were people, the producers you didn't want to work with, and you didn't send people, you didn't recommend
producers
them.
I think producers, like with certain managers in any industry, of course, the people in the powerful position who get to... not manipulate, what do they get to do? They have authority over other people. They're always dubious figures or can always...
Power corrupts. Yes, but the thing is, people, going back to your question, people think that I used to be a porn star, and that's one of the things. And the reason why I didn't is I knew that I wanted to politically take porn forward for women.
Yeah.
And I knew I wouldn't get taken seriously if I ever went in front of the camera.
Yeah.
And I knew, so I kind of forewent that. And I'm glad I did. I was right, and it works, etc. And I got to, stand for election and stuff like this, which I wouldn't have been able to do. But that's terrible that somebody should have to make that choice, because that's just the polarizing. Like, it's okay to.
Yes.
But porn directors get it in the neck in another way. Like, as a woman, I'm seen as not being a victim, but being a abuser.
Yes.
So I'm anti other women. Like, I abuse other women for my own sort of white middle class kind of background. So that's kind of, that's what I have to deal with. It's just, you know, different shit on the same day.
Yeah, absolutely. So if there's, for anyone listening to this conversation, if there's a really common misconception, or the most common, what's the thing that you would most like people to know? That they might not know already, something that you understand that you feel like isn't commonly understood.
It's difficult because one of the things I want to say is that porn is like a lot of other jobs.
Yeah.
But then I kind of lost the gauge as what other jobs were like before porn, because it's so many years ago. I think that. That we're not like a totally different set of people, that really it could be your brother or your sister, and it really is very much very widespread, and also that a lot of people, even the people that campaign against porn, are using pornography.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So that even if somebody says a lot of, like, gives it all this about, you know, to you about pornography, makes you try and feel bad, you might ask yourself the question, why do they feel the massive urge to do that?
Why are they doing this massive study where they have to watch all this porn? How do we get people to pay for pornography?
Well, if I'd worked that out,
I'd still be
in the industry.
It must be so hand in hand with shame. But to me, the thing that became clearest was that there should just be a Netflix where you pay £8 a month, and that would sort out so many problems. Really, if it was ran properly, you also then, for everyone who's going, oh, how do I find ethical porn, or how do I make sure it's not one of these gonzo sites where it's like, well, and also the people in the porn would continue to get paid, which is what should happen.
I mean, yes.
Like royalties.
It's, it's like that. I mean, there are loads of places that are kind of like tube sites that, as producers, they'll steal your content and put it up.
Yes.
So you don't know whether that's been stolen.
Yes.
My stuff is, I was just talking about this morning, like, I worked out that I had, I think it was like £300,000 worth of porn stolen off me in a space of 2 months online.
So what happens is you put it up through your streams or your hosting, and someone else
just buy the DVD and they upload it back in the day.
Okay.
So, and the point is that what happens with that, people want porn free, they want music free.
But I'm
old enough to know, looking at the music industry, say, we used to pay $20 for a ticket to go and see our favourite band.
Yes, yeah.
You are paying for huge, way more than we ever paid. You'll pay for gigs now. But that's where the money's going. So you're not actually getting that music for free. You're paying for it through other means.
Yeah.
But with porn, we don't have that equivalent. People aren't going to convene. They will go to the odd expo here and there, but even those have been suffering terribly.
Yeah.
So we don't have that. We don't have the ability for advertising because no one wants to touch us and stuff like that. Even though we've got the stream, you know, the web, you know, width, you know, the amount of users. So we're stuck in a difficult situation. So when I found out who was, you know, that I was losing that amount of money, what happens was I just actually just went into academia and did my PhD, and I got out because there's just no money in it. I was faced with the, you know, either... you know, making it cheap and piling it high and doing something I wasn't proud with, or just getting out of the industry. Yeah. So I got out of the industry and, you know, I lost, I think it was like 70% of income between 2007 and 2008. Yes. Just went off a cliff.
Which is just awful, isn't it?
And the thing is that there are people who need to understand when they take copyright, that I would have supported, I was just starting up Women Love Porn, and I would have supported a load of different female porn directors with that $300,000, right? That would have been real change in culture.
Yeah.
But because that was robbed, that didn't happen. And this is happening. It's the small companies. It's the variety.
Independence and things.
That really suffer. Because the big companies can just, you know, wing it.
Yeah, there was something when John Ronson's first podcast, which is called The Butterfly Effect, I'm sure you've heard it, about the tube sites, and he's interviewing people who are on them, who star in the most watched porn videos and who have other jobs now and don't receive any money for it. And he interviews someone who like can't get a bank account because the money earned from porn, with a bank manager who's going to wank to her video the minute she's left, kind of situation.
Well, we can't get bank accounts because banks won't give us. There's a whole prejudice.
The economic thing underneath it, and the idea that everyone masturbates to pornography, yet at the same time they don't think anyone should be rich from making pornography, or that you're a bad person. And I think that's a really huge thing. If everyone just said, "Oh yeah, I masturbate and I have that." That site where everyone's well paid and nothing's stolen, and you can still find everything.
Exactly.
You can still have all of the novelty. It's not kind of boring. Like, oh, it's just men and women kissing.
Exactly. Mm.
Mm. Someone do that then, please. I'll make it better. Thank you so much for talking to me. I will put a little thing at the beginning about you and a little thing at the end. But is there anything you'd like to plug? Is there anything that you're up to that you'd like people to know about?
Well, I'm currently working on a autobiography.
Yeah, about your life. Yeah.
And I'm writing that into kind of like my philosophy about sex and gender as well, but also kind of like my stories going back.
Okay.
Some really quite horrific stories going back, bumping into con men and stuff when I first started, not from actually the porn industry, but from outside. This is the thing, when people holler... Anyone that is working in the sex industry, be very wary of anyone that holidays in porn that are not established, but they're just trying it out because they don't know that there are a set of guidelines that we as industry members have to abide by or people won't work for us.
Yeah.
So, yeah, be careful of those rogue kind of agents and stuff like that. So I'm writing that, but that's not out yet. I mean, you can see my website, annaarrowsmith.com.
Yes.
My films, annaspanfilms.com, and also my book, Rethinking Misogyny, which is about how men experience women to have power in dating relationships.
Amazing. Brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. This has been Sex, Power, Money with me, Sarah Pascoe. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please recommend it to your friends. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and give us a 5-star review so that other people can find it. Sex, Power, Money is also the name of my book that's sometimes been mentioned in the podcast. I'd love you to read it if you'd like to find out more and have your own discussions with your friends. Thank you so much to Anna Arrowsmith. If you want to find out more about her, she has a website, annaarrowsmith.com, and her sex industry information site, weconsent.org. Next week, I'll be talking to stripper, theatre creator, and artist Joanna Nastery.